From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR Sports Show, Only a Game. Three stories you should know about this week include the Women's World Cup, intentional fouls in the NBA, and Michael Sam's brand new football job. Those are just ahead on Only a Game. Also, a look at Spanish soccer nationalism just before the country's prestigious Copa del Rey. Old friend Jenny Reese of the Louisville Courier-Journal explains what a triple crown would mean to horse racing and how the game of hoop rolling inspires social progress at a women's college. Also coming up, a new documentary explores the truth about lying on Wall Street in everyday life and among people involved in sports, including disgraced former NBA referee Tim Donaghy.
I definitely started to do things that I shouldn't have done, and by the time that I wanted to get out, I found myself in the back of a car with people associated with the Gambino crime family.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. There are a lot of interesting stories in the world of sports, too many to cover in the hour that we have each week. So we've enlisted some help to bring you developments too good to ignore. This week, we've invited Boston Globe Enterprise reporter Shira Springer and our own Doug Tribou to join us for something we're going to call Three Stories You Should Know. Okay with you two if I go first?
Sure.
Sure.
I've been watching at least parts of a lot of the NBA playoff games, and I'm thinking the league should create a rule limiting how often guys can intentionally foul players who are notoriously bad at shooting free throws. Because without such a rule, fans are going to get tired of witnessing the incompetence of men being paid millions of dollars to put the ball in the basket, and there's nobody in front of them, there's nobody waving their hands, and they can't do it, and the fans are going to find something else to watch. Shira, should the NBA change the way these games are played, or at least the way the fouls are given?
I think we're headed in that direction. I think we will see a rule change coming sometime this summer when the competition committee meets in Las Vegas in July. I think they really have to review this because it's painfully slow to watch these games proceed with all these fouls. And it's boring for the television viewer, something they're very concerned. They want that audience entertained if they're not in the arena.
It's a part of the problem at the end of games. We've got all sorts of
if it's the Rockets,
timing.
It's a part of the problem at the beginning of the game.
I know. Didn't they foul DeAndre Jordan like 3 minutes and 40 seconds into the game?
The opening whistle started. Yes. It was ridiculous.
To me, the overall problem is the end of the NBA games. You've got too many timeouts, too many stop starts. It's not just hacking the guys that can't make the foul shots. It's the number of fouls and the number of timeouts the coaches are allotted. You literally can turn the last 2 minutes of a game into 15 minutes.
But you played sports, Doug, when you were growing up. I know you played basketball. Do these guys not realize that if you shoot 50 foul shots in the gym when practice is over, you're going to get better than 30% from the line?
I don't know. I think Shaquille O'Neal is counting his money in his championship rings and not worrying about that.
I think the obvious solution is if you intentionally foul a player, the team that incurred the foul gets free throws and possession back. And that seems to be the most logical way to solve this problem without really disrupting the play.
All right. You have solved that problem, I think, admirably. I'm going to ask now for your candidate for the next story we ought to be checking out.
My candidate is the Women's World Cup. It is kicking off on June 6th, and there hasn't been enough pre-tournament hype, in my opinion. Nothing even remotely close to what we've seen in previous men's World Cups, particularly with Brazil last year. And the women are this country's soccer powerhouse, the team that has actually won two previous World Cup titles.
Number two in the world as we speak.
Exactly. Number two to Germany. They deserve national attention that goes beyond the legal troubles of their goalie, Hope Solo, and beyond the controversy of playing games in this World Cup on artificial turf instead of natural grass. You know, it's not a question of whether they'll advance out of the first round as it was for the men. If the U.S. wins, it would be the team's first World Cup title since 1999, when, as we all remember, they played in front of a packed Rose Bowl. There were 90,000 people watching that game. And now the game is better. The players are better. There's more depth across the board, and it deserves more attention.
What is the explanation for the fact that it isn't getting more attention and as you pointed out, much less attention than it got back in 99.
I think part of it, unfortunately, is gender. Women's sports simply doesn't marshal as much attention, as many headlines as the men's game. And I also think the U.S. soccer hasn't done as good a job as it did with the men of marketing its players. I think there are only two or three players that may be marginally household names. You think of Alex Morgan, you think of Abby Wamba, and of course Hope Solo because of her troubles.
Yeah, so but also because she's been a great goalie.
And I mean, also because of,
yes, she's also been
absolutely,
a terrific player.
Absolutely. But recently, I think if you talk to the up-and-coming generation, mm-hmm. they know her from her headlines, unfortunately. There should be more attention, you shouldn't see promotion for the Women's World Cup during softball games and during women's basketball games. It should be across the spectrum in all sports where you should be seeing this tournament hyped.
I don't know what the answer to this is, but when these kinds of conversations come up about women's sports and men's sports and promotion, there is something about the team and the individual. You know, Venus Williams and Serena Williams and some of the top world figure skaters, they become stars individually. But as you were saying earlier, the individual stars of this team are not what they once were in previous iterations.
And they're great stories with this women's team. I mean, I think of just besides the stars that some may know about, there is a 40-year-old woman, Christy Rampone, who's playing in her fifth World Cup. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And I know there's a great story to write about there, and more people should know it.
Okay, Doug, it's your turn.
My story that you should know is that Michael Sam, the NFL's first openly gay player, he was drafted last year, cut by two teams, has signed with the Canadian Football League's Montreal Alouettes. And this is something you should know for a couple of reasons. Yes, he becomes the first openly gay Canadian Football League player, but also this shows that this is a guy who is smart. There are players who have done phenomenally well by making this move. Most notably, Warren Moon, who went on to become a Hall of Fame quarterback. He couldn't find a starting job, couldn't find a home in the league, went to Canada, came back to the NFL, and was dominant. And there are other examples as well. Doug Flutie started in the NFL, went to the Canadian Football League, came back and had better success in the NFL. Tim Tebow, in my opinion, should have been doing this for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. Now, he's coming back to the NFL, but would he be a better player if he had spent maybe two seasons actively playing in Canada? I think Michael Sam is making a smart football move and also good for the Canadian Football League.
Yeah, seems to me to also demonstrate his determination. I mean, somebody cut twice by two NFL teams might have figured the story was over. He's determined enough to play football to find himself another place to play, and good on him.
Yeah, you kind of thought that determination might be waning when he signed up for Dancing with the Stars. But clearly,
you don't think that's a good way to stay in shape?
No. But clearly he's seen the light and recognizes that dancing is not the best
preparation
career for him. Yes.
Thank you, Shira Springer of the Boston Globe, and our own Doug Trabue. Thank you very much. We're going to have to do this again, I think.
Definitely.
Yes. Next weekend, FC Barcelona and Athletic Bilbao will meet in Barcelona's Camp Nou Stadium to play the final of the Copa del Rey, or King's Cup, Spain's national soccer championship. Named the Generalissimo's Cup during the reign of dictator Francisco Franco, the Cup has served as a kind of proxy for the Spanish political situation since it was first played in 1902. This year's version is no different. Ian Mount has the story from Barcelona.
In his 73 years, Martí Dalmases has seen a lot of Barcelona soccer games at Camp Nou. Exactly how many? Well, that requires some thought.
If there were 19 annual games in La Liga, plus the Copa, plus the Champions League, 19, 20, 30, 35, damn, multiply 35 by 75 or by 70, I don't know how to multiply anymore.
Dalmases is the president of the Casal de l'Avi Barça, which roughly translates as the Barça grandpa's house. Tucked into a few rooms at Camp Nou, the Casal is a clubhouse for retired fans who are paid up in their team dues. The walls are decorated with images of a Santa Claus-like character in burgundy and blue tights, the Barça grandpa. Around Dalmases, old socios play cards and bang down dominoes with the force, if not the finesse, of a Lionel Messi goal.
Being a Barcelona fan is like a philosophy. It's not a normal club. There are lots of people who sign up their child as a Barça member before they go to the registry to get the birth certificate.
According to Dalmases, his father showed great restraint. He waited until Damase's turn 7 before registering him as a paying fan, making him number 909 of the 150,000 or so current members. During the Franco dictatorship, Damase's grew up in Gracia, a town that was swallowed by Barcelona as it expanded. In an era before traffic jams and parking meters, he spent his days doing what all kids did, playing soccer in the streets.
I've experienced a lot of soccer. When I was little, in bad times, not to mention names, all there was football.
Dalmases eventually reached the youth squad of a nearby professional team, but soccer stardom was not in his future. So Dalmases learned his father's trade as a leather goods sales rep and became a professional Barca fan. During his years of intense fandom, he's learned the essential truth of Spanish sports.
In Spain, sports is politics, a lot of politics. And with so much politics, we want our enemy to lose, no matter what, even if it's unfair.
The enemy Dalmases refers to is Real Madrid. For many fans in Barcelona's region of Catalonia, where a good number of people want to secede from Spain, Real Madrid stands in for the hated central government and for Generalísimo Franco, who singled out Barcelona for heavy bombing during the Civil War and banned the use of the local Catalan language after he won. Having spent decades marinating in this cultural loathing, Dalmases hates Real Madrid so much he won't even attend the games when they come to play Barcelona.
My religion and my doctor don't permit me to. I'm sorry. To say it in a nice way, here we believe that the official institutions still exert pressure in favor of Real Madrid.
That brings us to the Copa del Rey. This year, the finalists are Barcelona and Athletic Bilbao. The obvious place for the final would be Real Madrid's Santiago Bernabeu Stadium, a huge venue in a neutral city. But as you might imagine, there were issues. When the same two teams played a Copa del Rey final in Valencia 6 years ago, Barcelona fans holding Catalan independence flags took advantage of the opportunity to voice their dislike of the royal family and other Madrid-based institutions loudly. Damases was there, of course.
It was all Catalan and Basque flags, and they whistled down the national anthem when the king and queen entered.
And so, when Barcelona and Athletic asked Real Madrid to borrow the Bernabeu for the 2012 final, Real said they couldn't because the team was supposedly renovating the stadium bathrooms. When the teams asked again this year, Real Madrid didn't even bother to make up an excuse.
They didn't allow us, as they believe were foreigners.
Another big stadium in Madrid wasn't available because AC/DC was scheduled to rock out there the same night, and locations in Valencia and Sevilla were deemed too small or too far away. So the game ended up in Camp Nou, and yes, Dalmases will be present.
At the end, when the players go on the field, everything else is forgotten. They're going to win the game because it's an important cup. Barcelona can win the three cups it's playing this year.
And, he is quick to add, Real Madrid cannot win any. For only a game, this is Ian Mount in Barcelona.
If American Pharoah can win at Belmont Park on June 6th, oh no, have I jinxed the attempt to win horse racing's Triple Crown by even mentioning the horse's name? Jenny Reese, who writes about the races for the Louisville Courier-Journal, joins me now to take me off the hook, I hope. Jenny, since Affirmed last won the Triple Crown in 1978, 12 horses have raced at Belmont Park with a shot at that Triple Crown, and 12 times they've fallen short. Is there any hope this time will be different?
I do think American Pharoah has some attributes that could make this one different. He's got the kind of speed that works very well in the Belmont, but he's also versatile, and he has looked very well. He's training at Churchill Downs, and that's not always the case with horses after the first two legs of the Triple Crown.
Do you think, as horse racing has changed, that it's gotten harder for a horse to win the Triple Crown? Obviously, it's been a while since it's happened.
Without question, it's much more difficult. Not only is it tougher because there's so many more horses in these races, and if American Pharoah wins the Belmont, he will have beaten more horses to win the Triple Crown easily than any of the other 11 Triple Crown winners. Mm-hmm. But it's not just that. It's also harder to qualify to get into the Derby. Training's different. There's this qualification system. And because more than 20 owners are wanting to go in the Derby. Horses have to do a lot just to get to the Derby, and that adds on to it, too.
Jenny, horse racing has been in decline for many years. We've talked about that a number of times. If American Pharoah does win the first Triple Crown since 1978, what will it mean to the sport in the short and the long run?
I think it's a short-term blip. In the long run, I think there's fundamental problems that has to do with the everyday product and getting new fans in that it's not going to make a difference in. There might be some people that follow it through this run because the horse is going for the Triple Crown. But as somebody said to me this morning, you know, if this horse doesn't do it, people think it's never going to happen, so why should I be interested in it? And, you know, that's kind of the point. But I think we are going to get the right horse one day, and maybe this is the horse, but it is not going to be the savior of horse racing.
Finally, this week, American Pharoah's stud rights were sold to Coolmore. So do his people keep racing after the Belmont, or does he get to bask in early retirement as the most expensive horse daddy in the land?
I think he's a shorter price, that if he wins the Belmont, he will not race again, and I think that's very unfortunate. I really think that just the value, they won't want to risk anything happening to the horse. But this is a terrific horse, and I just think it would just really be a shame to where some people would be really almost sorry that if he can't go on and race, then, you know, what a tease this was.
Jenny Reese covers the ponies for the Louisville Courier-Journal, and it's been far too long since I last spoke with you, Jenny. It's been a pleasure as always. Thank you very much.
Well, it's always fun, Bill.
On a beautiful summer day, surrounded by green, these gleaming animals on a green turf course, there's little that is more simply aesthetically beautiful than that.
That's Teresa Gennaro, a freelance horse racing writer and publisher of the blog Brooklyn Backstretch. She's also a high school English teacher in New York. With American Pharoah preparing to race for the Triple Crown on June 6th, we asked Teresa to tell us about how she balances her love of horse racing, a sport where the stars are sometimes mistreated, with her love of animals. Here's Teresa Gennaro in her own words.
My parents, when I was quite young, 3 or 4 years old, they bought some inexpensive harness horses, the ones where the drivers don't ride on top of them, but in the sulkies behind them. We began spending many summer and fall weekends in Saratoga Springs, New York, where we eventually moved when I was 13. And my dad used to bring us to see our horses on the backstretch and in the stables. And they did very much feel like our pets. You know, we used to go back and feed them sugar and feed them carrots and pet them. And most of our horses we were lucky they were quite gentle, and they suffered little children with great equanimity. My parents didn't keep the racehorses for that long. It's an expensive hobby. And when you grow up in a town with a racetrack, it's part of the social life. So just as my friends and I used to go out to the park or to the playground in the summer in our free time, we also would go to the racetrack. When I was a little girl, about 10 years old, I saw Ruffian's match race. I was watching it on television. Ruffian was undefeated at that point. She was this very dark filly. Everybody thought she was the best horse in the country. She was better than the boys. And in order to prove it, a match race was set up. So it was just her against another 3-year-old, a horse called Foolish Pleasure, and it was at Belmont Park. And like a lot of little girls then, I loved her. She was beautiful. She was an athlete. And she was a girl. My parents made sure that I got to see that race that day, which seemed like a great idea at the time, but ended up being just nightmarish. Not long into that race, she broke her leg.
Ruffian has broken down. Ruffian is stopped. Foolish Pleasure continuing.
And she didn't die instantly. They took her off the track, and she had surgery, and we learned a few days later that she had died. And it was unbearable for me, and I, in fact, didn't pay attention to horse racing for a long time after that because it seemed so unfair that horse that ran so hard could have that happen to her. I don't even remember exactly how it happened. I got a little bit involved in some animal rescue groups in Brooklyn where I live. I have a really hard time with animal suffering, and I try to do what I can to alleviate it in very small ways. I think sometimes it's really hard to reconcile. There are times where I look at horse racing and it's hard for me to explain to people who think it should be abolished why it should not be on a
strictly animal welfare level if you wanted to make sure that horses were not going to get hurt and they weren't going to die in horse racing. The only way to do that is to not have horses race anymore. That said, it's not going to go away, and I guess I like to hope that by being a part of it, I can be a small part of trying to make it better. That may be a rationalization for me to continue doing something I enjoy, even as I sometimes question it. I will never forget a number of years ago when I was very, very green. I went to a small track that doesn't have a great reputation because I was tracking down a horse that I had seen race a number of years earlier, and he had just taken my fancy. He hadn't been in my watch list for a long time. I had no idea what happened to him. And all of a sudden, 3 years after he retired, he showed up again and he was racing again. And I was very intrigued by this, and I tracked him down and I tracked his trainers down, and at this point, he was 7 or 8 years old. He'd had some injuries. And I had found a retirement farm that would take him if I could get the trainer to give him to me. And so I went. I traveled to it was a little track in the Mid-Atlantic. And I introduced myself to the trainer. And as I was standing there, and this is it's a hard scrabble track. Their purses that they run for aren't very big. It's a difficult place to make a living. And I watched a man on a horse come off the track, and she was a young horse. Excuse me. And she was scared, and she was acting up, and he took his whip, he took his crop, and he just whacked her between the ears with it. And I was horrified, and I felt like I was so far out of my league. The woman was quite resistant. She was a woman trainer, and she was kind to me. She sort of indulged me. I gave her my card, and I drove away, and I said, I've done everything I can. I need to just put this behind me. And 2 years later, she called and said that she couldn't make a go of it anymore, and if I could send a van, I could have him. And he's living at a wonderful retirement farm in the Hudson Valley. Like with any industry, there are some very, very good people in it, and there are some bad people in it. As a writer, if I can spread the word about the good stories of responsible owners who do the right thing by their horses, perhaps it will encourage other people to do the same thing.
Teresa Gennaro writes about horse racing and teaches English at a high school in Brooklyn. To see a picture of Teresa with Tiebreak, the horse she retired, visit onlyagame.org. A new film titled Dishonesty, The Truth About Lies, includes a montage of denials of wrongdoing by Alex Rodriguez, Rafael Palmero, and Lance Armstrong, who, as it was later revealed, were all lying. The film uses clinical evidence to assert that human beings are characterized by the ability to cheat and feel good about themselves, and it offers explanations about why we do that. Joining me is Dan Ariely, professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University. He's featured prominently in the film. Dan, welcome to Only a Game.
Great to be here.
And also joining us is one of the people profiled in the film, former NBA official Tim Donaghy, who was sentenced to 15 months in prison after the 2007 NBA betting scandal. Tim, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Tim, I'm going to start by asking you about this human ability to cheat and feel good about oneself. That's how Professor Ariely puts it in the film. When you were passing information to gamblers during your days as an official in the NBA, were you feeling good about yourself?
I think I was feeling good about myself in the sense that I knew that I was able to predict the outcome of games. So in that sense, you know, I felt good that I was able to provide them information that they were able to capitalize on.
Professor Ariely, does what Tim just said fit into your understanding of, quote, the truth about lies?
Yes. And one of the things Tim described in the movie is the fact that when he moved from college basketball to professional basketball, the rules seemed to have changed. All of a sudden, it seemed less about basketball and more about entertainment. In fact, they wanted to create a game that gets more excitement, that had some kind of leeway for more famous players and so on. Now, think about what happens when you come to a system and the system doesn't behave well. What happens to your own morality? And let me describe to you one experiment we're just doing. In this experiment, people have a six-sided die, and we pay them based on what the die comes up on. If it comes on five, you get $5, three, and so on. And I tell you, look, you can get paid based on the top side or the bottom side. Top or bottom, you decide, but don't tell me. So you roll the die, and let's say it came up with 2 on the top and 5 on the bottom. Now, if you decided bottom, you say bottom and you get $5. But if you decided top, now you have a dilemma. And when we get people to play this many, many times, we find that people are extra lucky. Basically, people lied. I think that's basically what happened, is that Tim moved to this new system. He felt the system was working on different rules. And all of a sudden, it was easy to abandon everything he was taught about what being a referee in basketball actually means.
When I talk about something like this, I don't ever want anyone to misinterpret the fact that I understand what I did was 100% wrong, but your discussion of that was 100% correct. I would be in situations where I would get information and I would take that information knowing that the outcome of a game was going to be influenced by that, and it was just very easy for me to pass it along, and I crossed a line that I shouldn't have been near. And, you know, with discussing this and with being a part of this movie, I'm hoping that others are able to learn so that the choices that they make in life are definitely the better choices rather than going down that easy and fun road that I went down.
There's one more thing I want to emphasize, though, is, you know, when Tim and many of the other people we talk to reflect back on what they're doing, everybody asks themselves, how could I have done that? But you see, what is really hard to do is to put yourself back into the mindset of the moment. So you think about somebody like Lance Armstrong. When he had an interview with Oprah, she said, didn't you feel at the moment that you were cheating? And he said, no. And he sounded like a psychopath when he was saying it. But the fact is that in the moment, our ability to rationalize what we're doing is so high that we don't pay attention.
Tim, in the film, you say that you had no direct contact with then NBA Commissioner David Stern about giving star players preferential treatment when it came to calling fouls. But there were other channels by which you got that message. What were those channels?
What they did was they had group supervisors that were responsible for 12 referees. We were put in groups, and they would tell you that LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, Shaquille O'Neal, when you call a foul on them, make sure that it's a very obvious foul that everybody in the building knows that they committed. And when they get to the point where they have 2 or 3 fouls, if you can, pass on that foul, because nobody comes and pays large amounts of money to see these guys sit on the bench. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if there were 2 people on the play and Shaquille O'Neal and a lesser player was involved and you could give that foul to that other guy, that's what they told you to do. It was the craft of NBA officiating.
In the film, cyclist Joe Papp talks about using EPO in 2006 to boost his performance by, in his words, upwards of 12% to 13%. Papp made the choice to do that, obviously, but he said it was an easy choice because of the culture of cycling at the time. Again, here's a little bit from the film.
Everyone was complicit in it. You all have a shared interest in keeping it quiet and actually supporting one another in it.
Professor Ariely, what does research say about Papp's mindset at that time?
So his story is fascinating because it's truly a story of unraveling of one small act versus another, and then another, another, another. And the way he described it is that he went off cycling for a couple of years. He came back, and he was as good as he was, but everybody else was faster. And he asked one of his friends what's going on, and his friend gave him an address. And he went to see a physician with a white coat and a stethoscope, and the physician wrote him a prescription for EPO. And he went to the pharmacy, and his insurance paid for the drug, and he only paid the copayment. And he said that the first time he took the drug, he thought about it. But then he stopped thinking about it, and it just became a part of his routine. And then later on, he found out that everybody else was doing it. They started doing it in public. Then they started adding more drugs to it. The whole thing just became worse and worse and worse. And that's something that we see all the time. And it's a tremendous warning sign for all of us. You know, sometimes you look at big cheaters and you say, how did these people get to this? I could have never done that. But when you look at the first step of what they do, which is what we try to do in the movie, you say, you know what? I could have done that.
Tim, I'm curious about your take on that, because the way it comes across in the movie, the theory is that in any moral conflict, there's a line. And looking back, you might see that you had crossed a line at some particular point. Is that the way you see what you did and what happened to you?
Oh, definitely. And to hear Dan talk about it, I get goosebumps that just go through my whole body, because I definitely started to do things that I shouldn't have done. And by the time that I wanted to hit the brakes and get out, I found myself in the back of a car with people associated with the Gambino crime family, and there was no turning back. So when he tells that and speaks of that, I do get chills that go through my body thinking back to that moment.
Tim, your officiating career ended 8 years ago. What are you up to now?
Right now, I actually manage a website called refpicks.com, which just allows somebody who is placing bets to have a little bit of an inside edge on what's going on. My profession now was not my first choice, but because of the poor choices that I had made in the past, it made it difficult for me to come back and rebound and find another career because of the extent of my story being in the news and the label that I had of being a disgraced NBA basketball referee. So I just want everybody to know that it definitely was not my first choice, but it was something that enabled me to provide something for my four daughters. So that's why I got into it, and it became so successful so quick that it was something that I almost felt like I had to do.
Tim Donaghy is a former NBA official. He served 11 months in prison for illegal gambling. Tim, I thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And Professor Dan Ariely is featured throughout the film, Dishonesty, the Truth About Lies. Dan, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, an Ivy-bedighted college sees social change as inspired by competitive hoop rolling. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Nothing like a good hoop roll, Bill.
Nothing, absolutely. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman has some new science to share regarding concussions, Charlie. He said at a press conference earlier this week that there is no evidence of a link between concussions and CTE. Wait a minute. That story came out in 2002, right?
Perhaps there's no evidence lying around his living room or in his kitchen or between the cushions of the sofa. But I'm sure if he went out in the world and talked to some neurologist, he could find some.
Yes, or even some retired hockey players.
If they remember that they played hockey at all.
Does this now mean that the NHL replaces the NFL as the league with the worst leadership on the concussion issue?
Well, if it didn't already, considering they locked its players out twice in the last decade. But this is a singularly dumb thing to say.
In other hockey news, the Tampa Bay Lightning, currently toiling in the Eastern Conference Finals, have adopted a ticket policy that can be summarized as no Rangers fans allowed. Wait a minute, this is still the United States of America, right? Can they do that?
Apparently the rule is you can't wear Rangers regalia to the games. That's going to make it awfully hard for the actual New York Rangers to play down there, isn't it?
Well, I think as long as you're on the ice, you can probably wear a Rangers shirt, but fans won't be allowed into those games.
So it's okay for Henrik Lundqvist to wear his uniform?
Yeah.
Well, that's
good. That's all right.
At least they're not rigid about this policy.
According to Lakers general manager Mitch Kupchak, Kobe Bryant is saying that next season will be his last with the Lakers. That clause, last with the Lakers, does that mean he's going to go play somewhere else?
Well, I think it's interesting that it was phrased that way. So, I mean, it is possible that he might want to play out a couple of years somewhere else.
Do you have a sense, even at this early stage, where he might fit well?
Not in the least. I mean, unless he really wants to go to Chicago and show up Michael Jordan.
Beginning next season, NFL extra point attempts will be kicked from the 15-yard line instead of from the 2-yard line. According to a headline I read this week, this will make things, quote, slightly more interesting. Not to me, but what about for everybody else?
Well, I would phrase that as slightly less boring. I mean, the first time somebody screws it up, we're going to hear what a genius move this is on the part of the NFL, but it really doesn't matter that much.
Well, my question is this. Now that in a time when people are talking about the NFL 12 months of the year for one reason or another, why does it have to become slightly more interesting? They're on top of the heap already.
Yeah, I mean, their unbelievable inability to stop tinkering with a product that's selling wildly is very strange.
Suppose that you'd been at the owners' meeting at which this new rule was adopted. Is there a rule that you might have proposed?
Yes, stop making silly little adjustments in the rules. And then I'd hit the buffet.
There's a new lawsuit against the NFL. Ex-players, including three members of the 1985 Super Bowl champion Chicago Bears, alleges that the NFL forced players to use narcotics that were illegally obtained and administered. What are the ex-players asking for?
Lots of money. And if the NFL is in any way smart, they'll settle this sucker as fast as they can, because this puts every franchise at risk.
Okay. You ready for a quiz?
Absolutely.
What team, all sports considered now, features the highest average player salary?
Which team?
Which team has the highest
average? Are we talking American sports? We're not talking about, like, Manchester United or something, right?
I open the field up to sports, all places.
If I had to guess, I'd say Barcelona.
Well, that would be a good guess, but it would be wrong. It's Paris Saint-Germain.
Zoot alor! How did that happen?
They're averaging 101,898 euro a week.
My goodness. I think Barcelona should be embarrassed. It's time to start paying people more.
Well, maybe after they win the triple this year, they will start paying people more. Milwaukee Brewers reliever Will Smith was ejected from Thursday's game in Atlanta for having a combination of rosin and sunscreen on his arm. I think they caught him because it was chilly and raining.
Yeah, I think they also caught him because there was this big, shiny mess of glop on his arm.
You mean you don't go along with me? If it had been a bright, sunny evening in Atlanta, they would never have caught him?
No, it looked like somebody had hit him with a wad of gelatin.
Speaking of baseball, what do you think about the way the Washington Nationals have been celebrating wins this year?
I think it's grotesque, Bill. They've been spraying Hershey's chocolate syrup on themselves. Please, bring back cheap champagne.
A locker room to avoid. And finally, the members of the University of Nebraska baseball team had to figure out something to do when they weren't taking batting practice or fielding ground balls or working on their studies. So they got in an elevator, all of them. How'd that work out?
Bill, I'll hazard a wild guess and say they got stuck.
Right you are.
Did the catcher at least not have his regalia on?
I don't think he could have, because the picture that shows them all jammed in there, I don't think there was room for equipment.
You know, I guarantee you there's a reserve right fielder in there that they haven't found yet.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland. This week, he's accused Patriots owner Robert Kraft of throwing his quarterback, about whom Charlie once wrote a book, under the bus. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
In the League of Outsider Baseball, Gary Sierodkowski has collected the stories of ballplayers ranging from preposterously obscure to utterly unappreciated. Lots of those players appeared in the major leagues, but two of the pitchers involved in an especially unlikely matchup did not. Kenzo Nushita pitched for the Pacific Coast League's Sacramento Senators in 1932, and in an early season tilt against the Oakland Oaks, Nushita was matched against Lee Gum Hung. It was a pairing that might have made any promoter of prize fights proud, and I think I'll let Gary Sierodkowski pick it up from there.
Yeah, it was 1932, and the summer of 32, and it's right in the depths of the Great Depression. It's just going to get worse. The Sacramento Senators had a not very good team that year, and they were looking to boost their attendance any way they could, and they wound up signing a guy by the name of Roy Nushita.
Nushita, born in Hawaii, was a pitcher in Northern California's Nisei Leagues. Japanese fans loved him.
He's a little guy. He's about 5'2", just about 100 pounds soaking wet, but he had this great curveball. He had a whole assortment of junk pitches that he would throw, and he just would baffle hitters. Number one, because he was so small. Number two, he would just be able to throw these crazy curves. So the Senators wind up signing him. It was a smart move because not only did they get a pretty good pitcher, but he came with his own ready-made fan base. All the Japanese-American fans that would see him in semi-pro fields started going to the Senators games to watch him pitch. So the Senators make a round of all the Pacific Coast League teams, and they come into Oakland. Now, Oakland has an even more miserable team than Sacramento at the time. They're just wallowing in a terrible place in the standings. So the owner of the team, this guy Vic Vincenzi, sees a marketing idea.
Japan's answer to the economic blizzard of the Depression was war. First, an invasion of Manchuria, and then China.
The owner of the Oaks looked out his window and saw that there was a huge Chinese-American population in Oakland. So he got a great idea. Not only was he going to get his own Chinese player to tap into this untapped market of Chinese-American fans, he's going to put him up against Nishida when he comes to town, and they're going to fight the Sino-Japanese War on the ball field. They go out and they try to find a suitable Chinese pitcher. Well, two of the guys on the Oaks had played high school baseball with a guy named Al Bowen. Al Bowen's real name was Lee Gum Hong. He was Chinese-American. He was about 6'2", big, burly pitcher, and he was a strikeout king on the sandlots of Oakland. Oakland signs him to a contract. The press starts playing up this Chinese-Japanese rivalry. Nishida never really made any comments about being Japanese or standing up for Japan. On the other hand, Hong started courting all the newspapers, and he was kind of like a pre-Muhammad Ali. He would just start, you know, railing to the press that he represents China and they're going to fight this and China's going to win this on the field. So, you know, he really whipped up the press into a frenzy.
Japan v. China as a pitching duel fizzled. Nushita hit the showers early and Hong left the game in the sixth inning.
So neither man wound up with the win that day. But there was about 3,000 Chinese fans that filled Oaks Park. They just went crazy, and they're throwing firecrackers, they're cheering on Li Hong, and it's a complete success. Back then in the 1930s, the Pacific Coast League would play 6 games in each city. So 5 days later, these two men start against each other again. And again, it's whipped up into this big Sino-Japanese war frenzy, and all the Chinese fans come out to represent Hong, and Japanese fans come and represent Nishida. It ends badly for Nishida again. He gets knocked out of the box pretty early. But Hong winds up pitching a 6-run game and wins 7-6. And so he winds up taking the Sino-Japanese War Battle Royale of the Pacific Coast League. To get 3,000 fans out to see two lousy teams in 1932 in the depths of the Depression, that was a huge deal. I mean, these people really came out in droves to support their guys. It's interesting to me that the Pacific Coast League didn't continue to tap into that.
Do we know whether Nishida and Hong ever shook hands after the game? Were they friends? Did they go have a beer together when this epic battle had concluded?
I don't think so. You know, before the game, they would take the pictures of the guys shaking hands and standing next to each other. Nishida went on to have a very, very successful semi-pro career, and he wound up going back to Hawaii, which is where he was born, and played baseball there for years. And Hong played for a few more years, and during World War II, he joined the State Department and represented the United States over in China for many years.
The game featuring Nishida and Hong is just one of the many stories told by Gary Sierutkowski in The League of Outsider Baseball, an illustrated history of baseball's forgotten heroes, though not forgotten by Gary. For ages, children rolled hoops for fun. The game has faded from popular culture, but at Wellesley College in Massachusetts, a hoop-rolling competition has survived. And as society has evolved, so has the definition of what it means to win. Our colleague and recent Wellesley graduate, Zoe Sobel, has our story.
It's 8:45 on a Saturday morning, and Wellesley College seniors are trickling down Tupelo Lane for the school's 120th hoop-rolling race. They gather clutching knee-high wooden hoops about 2 inches wide, ready to run. Underclass students have camped out in tents. Some have mimosas in hand. Excitement bubbles up at the starting line as more runners cram onto an impossibly narrow sidewalk.
Are you ready to roll?
Yeah!
Okay, on your marks, get set, go!
The seniors in the first row burst forward while those in the back are caught in a bottleneck. Each is vying to be the first to push a hoop down the quarter-mile paved course to the finish line at the chapel. Like other runners, Adrienne Ogle is wearing her long black graduation gown over her clothes.
You're getting, like, caught up in your robe, and other people are accidentally tripping each other with their hoops. So it is a mess. It is not graceful at all. Even though you're just running down a road, the speed at which everybody runs is a full sprint. You get to see your friends being like, you can do it, you're going to get there. And you're like, I don't know, I'm really bad at this.
The winner is presented with flowers, carried to the lake, and tossed in. Throwing the winner in Lake Wobbin began when a Harvard man dressed up as a Wellesley senior and won. When the students discovered he'd cheated, they dumped him in the lake. Every race since has ended in a ceremonial dunking. There's a lot of history and tradition here at Wellesley. The campus looks frozen in time, with brick buildings and towers wrapped in ivy. Hoop rolling at Wellesley dates back to the late 1800s. According to Wellesley's director of library collections, Ian Graham, students first picked up hoops as a part of May Day celebrations.
Students went to Boston to buy their hoops and then came back and didn't race around with them, but just rolled around with them in general, among the other activities they were sort of taking part in.
By 1917, the activity turned into a race. Eventually, students decided that winning actually needed to mean something. Like the bridesmaid who catches the bouquet at a wedding, the winner of the hoop rolling race would be the first to marry. Some of the runners who were already married pushed strollers instead of hoops.
I don't think with living babies in them, but I know of a picture that we have of a student was rolling a shopping cart with a baby doll in it.
By the late 60s and 70s, the strollers were gone. Racers decorated their hoops with peace signs. And when senior Adrian Ogle's mom, Joanne Avalon, graduated in 1982, winning the race had taken on yet another meaning.
I think when I graduated, there was a big push to be the lawyer, the doctor, the big name professional with the big paycheck.
During Joanne's time, the victor was said to be the first woman to get her PhD. But soon after, it changed again to being the first woman to become CEO. As graduation approaches, Joanne's daughter, Adrienne, is thinking about her definition of winning.
So I guess winning would just be getting what I want most, which at the moment would definitely be a steady job that I really like. I didn't win, so I don't know what's going to happen.
After graduation, Adrienne's heading off to California to follow her dream of working in the film industry. That's the kind of thing then-First Lady Barbara Bush encouraged when she talked about hoop rolling in her 1990 Wellesley commencement speech.
So I want to offer a new legend. The winner of the hoop race will be the first to realize her dream, not society's dreams, her own personal dream. And hoop.
During my time on the Wellesley track team, I ran dozens of races. I dreamed of winning hoop rolling, being the first to break the tape, and achieving success in a way I hadn't been able to on the track. But we all knew our classmate Alex Poon was going to win. For one family, success in this race has become a rite of passage. Helen Poon won the race in 1982. Her daughter Kathy was second in 2011. And then in 2014, the winner was Alex.
It was nice to stay within the tradition of hoop rolling and be able to carry on that family legacy while at the same time making a little history of my own as being the first trans person to win hoop rolling at Wellesley.
Alex is transgender and identifies as a man. His win comes at a time when more people are paying attention to transgender rights. In the years since Alex's win, historically women's colleges, including Bryn Mawr, Smith, and Wellesley, have reevaluated and changed their admissions policies to be more inclusive. Alex spent more time training for this race than thinking about what winning would mean to him. But his dreams happen to have a lot in common with those graduates from the 80s.
For me, though, I actually would like to be CEO someday, but of a company that helps other people.
Joanne Avalon didn't win the race in 1982, but she says then, like now, hoop rolling was never about the prize.
It's a metaphor, right? It was almost as though somebody was saying to you, okay, here it comes. This is life. It's going to be out of control. People are going to expect you to do objectively ridiculous things. And the only way you get through it is with your friends and with a sense of humor.
And she adds, maybe a mimosa too. For Only a Game, I'm Zoe Sobel.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. We had help this week from Glenn Alexander, and our intern is Joe Jacobs. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from psychology and behavioral economics professor Dan Ariely, who shares some of his findings regarding cheating in golf.
We asked people about how would you feel about picking the ball up and moving it by 4 inches. And people said, that's terrible. I mean, you don't play like this. And you know what's the easiest? To kick it a little bit when you're not looking.
Okay, hold on, Professor. So you're saying it's okay to kick it, right? Boy, that's a relief. I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.